but tomorrow they'll be held to pay.
And we are the Nonprofits. Welcome. After a hiatus, I'm Matt Delaney. Also this week on Nonprofits, Russell Glasser.
Hey.
Schilling.
Yes.
And Beth.
Hey.
And Dennis is not going to actually be here today, unfortunately. And we're also not streaming the show live today. I've had some issues with the cable. They were out here this morning fixing it. I think it's fixed. So maybe next week we'll be able to stream the show live from the new and possibly improved Dillahunty International Studios.
Awesome. It is, the new studio is very nice. A bit out of the way.
It is a bit out of the way. And I'm not sure about the acoustics in this room. We may need some kind of dampening or whatever, but we'll see how it goes. So yeah, let us know if the general audio has improved, gone down, whatever. Because the other studio was vast, and this is like recording kind of in a closet area, pretty much. So how's everybody been doing? And, but thanks, by the way, for doing the gorilla episodes while we were
shut down. It's always great fun to talk to Guy P. Harrison. And by the way, people who were having problems with the MP3, I re-uploaded a better one. So check that again if you haven't heard it already, because, you know, Guy P. Harrison.
Which reminds me, during the process of moving, Guy had given me a couple books, signed copies of 50 Reasons People Give for Believing in a God, for us to give away, and there's one that hadn't been given away yet, so we need to come up with some sort of, I don't know, contest, something incredibly lame.
Oh, lame. I was about to have a suggestion.
Oh, you were going to, if you have a non-lame suggestion, that's fine, I just...
I would say the person who can best tear apart an atheist argument, not necessarily a good one, but maybe a common one, and point out why that's a bad argument to use.
Great. I love it. So go find an atheist argument, or an argument that you're hearing quite often from atheists.
Not a straw man atheist argument.
Yeah.
One that atheists actually use.
And one that you think's not good. And rip it to shreds and send it to, what's our email address? Oh, it's radio@atheist-community.org.
I think nonprofits also works.
Nonprofits.
I wouldn't bet on that.
You can email it to TV at, from my point of view, they're all the same because they all go to the same inbox. So in the month or so that we've been gone, there's it's PZ's birthday today, and that's all we have to say about that.
Wasn't that yesterday, actually?
I don't know. Yesterday, today, whatever.
Well, I'd also like to mention, one, we're sponsored by Atheist Community of Austin.
Are we?
Which is worth mentioning now and then.
Are we actually sponsored by the Atheist Community of Austin? That's a good question, because it's time for everybody to renew their memberships.
Uh-oh.
I haven't done it. Has anybody else in here done it?
No.
So none of us are actually... I'm the president, and I'm not actually a member at this moment.
So even though this is at Dillahunty International Studios, it is actually perhaps a gorilla episode also.
Well, the hosting, thank you for the reminder, the hosting and everything else is sponsored by the Atheist Community of Austin, along with the equipment, and I will be a member again tomorrow, just as soon as I see my treasurer and take care of it. For those of you out there who needed the reminder, it's membership time. Hit the website. There's a way to actually join online.
And in addition to a number of other activities, we're doing the happy hour again as an ACA event at 7 to 8 p.m. is when it starts at the Dog and Duck at 17th and Guadalupe. The event was on a bit of a hiatus, but we've started it up again and we're growing it. And it's a really good time to come out and meet a few people and in a very relaxed setting and have a drink and some great food.
When Dennis isn't here, Schilling's in charge of announcements because I'm incompetent. It's strange because I intuitively don't want to do the same intro thing that I do on Sunday. So it's and when I leave it up to Dennis, it's fine. So cool. What else do we need to announce? The Reason Rally is coming up this month in Washington, D.C., which is followed immediately the next day by the American Atheist National Convention. I know Martin has said that he's going. I don't know if anybody else is.
I'm not.
Yeah.
I think we would have heard if somebody else was.
Yeah. So Martin is going. I'm not. I just don't have the vacation days to burn for it, you know. I wish I did, but I'm doing a bunch of debates and speaking engagements, and they require me to take vacation days, and I'd rather not lose my job. So by taking too many days off in a short period of time.
But I thought you got paid handsomely for these debates.
Oh, yes. Man, that guy's just, I don't know why he hates me so much. And the funny thing is, by the way, we're talking about somebody, the debate that I had in Amarillo a couple of weeks ago has been posted online. If you go to the Atheist Experience blog, I thought you were pulling it up for me so I could read the address.
freethoughtblogs.com/AXP.
There you go.
And then,
yeah, it's
within the last few days, so.
Is a post. I made the post, I think, yesterday when I found out that it got posted.
Right.
So you can go watch the debate. I think all of the Q&A and the closing arguments are on there. And it's like an hour and 40 minutes, maybe, something like that. Or I don't know, possibly longer. I stood there actually for 3 hours. So once everything else was over with, I took questions up at the table for quite a while. The one thing I will say about the debate, I don't want to give out too much information before more people have seen it. There's at one point in there where he got applause for saying something, and I didn't want to continue the back and forth because there were a bunch of people standing in line for questions and everything. At the time, maybe it wasn't about the questioners so much as I thought I'd kill the pacing to just try to get in one last dig. But I had made this example. We were talking about whether or not the United States should be a nation under God, and his entire argument was unalienable rights are necessarily from God. And my response was, I'm not even convinced we have unalienable rights. What good is a right that you know, rights are granted, rights are protected, rights are taken away. I don't even know what you mean. What good is it to have a right that you can't use? And so I did a quick example saying, if somebody walked in here and killed you, they've taken away your right to life. And he got up and said, they haven't taken away your right to life. They've taken away your life. And this incredibly overly Christian crowd just starts applauding like crazy. And I wanted to just immediately stand up and say, and that'd be a salient point if dead people actually had rights.
Right.
Yeah.
But I decided not to. I mean, that was probably the one thing that I regret is not saying that, because it would have been an applause line to counter his.
Right.
And to show that he's engaged in some really strange sophistry.
The phrase inalienable rights is one of those phrases that sounds nice and it sounds like a great thing. But when you really examine it, it's sort of defeating. It's sort of like unconditional love.
Yeah,
it sounds great and romantic, but when you examine what it means, it devalues love. Devalues rights.
What Jefferson was saying in the Declaration of Independence was, we hold these truths to be self-evident, which means this is the axioms from which we're starting.
Right.
And he did give some lip service to, you know, the creator, but he didn't get specific about that creator.
And neither did my debate opponent, which is fine.
Of course. I watched the first 40 minutes of the debate, and I might have been a little heavier on the Euthyphro if I was there. Like, you know, lots of societies do attempt to be under God, and the results are never pretty.
Yeah. There's plenty of things that I missed during the debate. In hindsight, you know, as I go back, most people have been, you know, really nice about it, and a few people have made some points, and I'm like, yeah, you know, I either thought about that and didn't use it, or I thought about it afterwards, and it's like the TV show. I replay it in my head over and over.
Yeah, I know how it is.
It was really frustrating because we came there to debate one thing, and his opening statement completely redirected everything, basically mimicking William Lane Craig's argument about morality and turning this into morality. And so I changed my entire opening statement on the fly to point out that I came there prepared for another debate entirely, but that I'll be happy to address this and the subject that we're talking about.
Well, it's an old politician trick. If you don't want to answer the question, then you just answer the question you wish they asked.
And somebody suggested that when I did my closing, which I also changed, I changed everything. Basically, I don't know why I brought any notes. That what I should have done was pointed out that we came here to debate, should America be a nation under God? And here's how you would have to meet those goals. And he didn't even come close to it. He spent his time talking about morality and some strange sophistry and the absurdity of of having rights that you can't exercise, which that entire conversation when he said they didn't take away your right to life, they took away your life. When I was trying to point out that, you know, rights are only as valuable as our ability to actually grant them and protect them, it reminded me of the scene from Life of Brian where they wind up agreeing that, you know, he can't actually have babies not having a womb, but he can have the right to have babies. Yeah, and that's how I felt about a good chunk of the debate. The reason I didn't do the closing like that of saying, here's what we would have needed to do in order to meet the burden, and I successfully did this and he didn't come anywhere near it, is because it may be a good idea. It's what I see guys like Craig doing over and over again. I don't think I want to be that kind of debater. I don't think I want to, ooh, look, I got a technical win. Mm-hmm. I'm there to present my position. I'm there to be a representative for atheism. I'm there to give, in places like Amarillo, where there were almost 700 people at this debate, biggest debate crowd I've done yet, and the biggest thing that they've done in that area. My goal is to make sure that those people will have to walk out of there saying, what I thought about atheists isn't really, you know, perhaps accurate. I may still not agree with them. I had Christians coming up to me afterwards saying all kinds of nice things. There were two guys who were kind of hostile, which I talked about on the show. There's a 13-year-old who emailed me who, because the debate now identifies as an atheist, his parents were secular and he just kind of hadn't committed anywhere on anything. And there was somebody else who emailed me who brought a Christian friend with him who was convinced that atheists were just Satan worshipers. And now they have a completely different outlook. So,
when quite often the closing, you know, there's something to be said for pointing out how you've trounced your opponent and, you know, things like that. But it seems better to me not to focus on what you did with respect to your counterpart in the debate, but what you think you've accomplished with respect to the audience.
Yeah.
Right. If I think that Eric guy was trash talking you last week about how, I'm sure that if you debated me, it would be obvious that I won, and his standards for winning. Was that last week?
Yeah, I think so.
And then it was the week before.
2 weeks ago, yeah.
Yeah. But so if 95% of the audience walked in as Christians, it would be insane to think that like 95% of them would walk out as atheists.
Yeah.
And because that would never happen, some people would declare that a victory for the Christian. But if 95% Christians walk in and 90% Christians walk out, you've kicked the guy's ass.
Well, yeah, even that is a little unrealistic in terms of.
Yeah, I'm not likely to convince. I don't think anybody's going to switch in the course of a single debate. What I took as a win was the fact that I learned some stuff. I know more things for the next time I do something like this. The people that I was there on behalf of were happy with the job that I did. I got along, you know, it didn't devolve into a mudslinging contest. Abdu and I actually, you know, have talked, you know, briefly since then. I don't know why I end up liking my debate opponents. We had dinner beforehand. And what brought us to this discussion a little bit ago was this guy who posted the blog, who has gone and made his own blog post. I love how his site...
He thinks of himself as our arch nemesis. I think he made his blog because of our blog, like, years and years ago.
And I notice his blog keeps referring to him as we. We are ministers, blah, blah, blah. I'm not aware of anybody else actually contributing on there, but there
me
may
and
be.
My tapeworm.
Yeah. But what he posted was, you know, I'm not going to give Matt any promotion since he's running around getting paid to do all these debates. And some people immediately jumped in and were like, whoa, 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 whoa. Matt didn't get paid for this. For clarity, my standard speaking or debating arrangement up until now has been I'll speak anywhere I'm invited as long as there's no out-of-pocket expense for me. I don't have a required honorarium, and I haven't requested a fee. Most of my events I've done absolutely free, apart from them, you know, flying me out or whatever. In this particular case, and in one or two other cases, somebody involved with the organization that brought me there would, you know, go to their ATM and here's a couple hundred bucks, thanks for your time type thing. So it's not honest to say that I didn't get any money for doing this, because I did get some money for doing this, but there was no paid agreement. This was somebody,
right,
you know, saying thank you with some money, which, you know, is appreciative. Now that's going to change, because I have to keep burning vacation days, and because the number of speaking gigs, well, I've had to turn down so many. I mean, I'm booked kind of through July. Something's going on every month in April. I don't know how we're going to do nonprofits in April. I guess guerrilla episodes. I'm going to try to get an intern up here, or at least make sure you guys know what to do to just do it.
Okay.
But we'll figure something out.
You know, I was producing the show before you.
I'm aware. And the box, that the soundboard that you used is actually in a box in that closet.
No. Oh.
But I won't make you use that one. You can use the new one.
Okay.
But so yeah, it's gonna change a little bit. I can't keep doing, you know, three events a month for free. But you know, I'll always have the option of doing it for free for student groups and anybody who can't afford it. It's not a big deal. So he came on and made that claim, and then he spent the rest of his time on the blog, which, you know, I'm not going to go over there and keep posting, talking about how I was getting paid to lie by saying I used to be a Christian when I so clearly wasn't a true Christian. I hope he's listening to this episode. I've made this clear about 20 times. I made it clear when I talked to Ray Comfort. I made it clear at dinner before the debate with Abdu. I don't get to decide who is or isn't a true Christian. You can use, if you're by your definition of who was a true Christian, I'm not one, then congratulations, I wasn't one. My thing is, if your definition of true Christian is somebody who actually does have a personal relationship with the living Christ, then I wasn't ever one.
And neither are you.
And I don't think anybody else is either. If your definition is somebody who thinks that they have a personal relationship with the living Christ, then I most definitely was one, and screw you if you don't believe me.
Somebody did go over to his blog, I checked his comments, and said, so I just think you're not a true Christian.
Yeah.
You know, there's no way to say.
Yeah.
That I love in the that future, you won't abandon your faith. So
I love that he said, oh, for the atheists out there, this isn't the no true Scotsman fallacy, because the Bible makes very clear what... No, the Bible doesn't make anything clear, and even if it did, it's still a no true Scotsman fallacy, because you're using your interpretation of this.
So step one, make fallacy X. Step two, mention fallacy X and say I'm not doing it.
That's a good plan.
Yeah.
Now, this isn't a shifting of the burden of proof, but you need to prove to me that God doesn't exist.
Right. Now you're getting it.
So there's other events coming up. JT and I are doing a debate in Plano at the beginning of April. I'll get more information about that as we get closer. There's an event in Binghamton, New York. I guess it might be good to know what I'm actually doing before I get there.
Probably.
Yeah.
But you know, given the nature of the debates, your preparation is... You know, if it's a debate about, you know, which morality is superior, then your preparation for this debate about whether America should be a Christian nation, that's when that will come in handy. When they shift the goalpost to something that you've had avoided before.
If I take enough debate topics, I'll just be able to debate every single point like in succession as we go around. So anyway, and enough about the here's what Matt's doing. We've actually got like news stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And so there's also the Imagine a Religion conference coming up in May in Kamloops, British Columbia. Bunch of other things. There's the Oklahoma Freethought Convention and more that we'll have information about. And this year, the Texas Freethought Convention is in Austin, although I don't yet have dates yet, but it will be in the fall. So that's the upcoming schedule. Who's got the first news thingy? Who are we beating up on first?
Let's see. Oh, why not beat up on Harold Camping first?
Oh,
he's been out of the news for a while, and it gives me an opportunity to use my Harold Camping voice.
You have a Harold Camping voice?
I have
voice.
A Harold Camping
let's,
voice.
Let's get it.
California preacher who convinced thousands of followers that the world would end has posted an online letter conceding he has no evidence of an impending apocalypse and will no longer predict global doom. In a missive posted Thursday on his independent ministry site, 90-year-old Harold Camping said he was asking for forgiveness for his sin in predicting Judgment Day and has stopped trying to pinpoint future dates.
We realize that many people are hoping that they will know the date of Christ's return, Camping wrote. We humbly acknowledge we were wrong about the timing.
Camping's Family Radio International broadcast. That's all I'll do there.
Broadcast. Yeah, a little more Brit with head injury than Harold Camping.
Have you heard Harold Camping?
Yes.
Broadcasts his messages from the nonprofit's headquarters in a squat building near the Oakland airport. In recent years, the organization spent millions of dollars, some of it from listeners' donations, putting up thousands of billboards plastered with his prediction of the rapture. Marie Exley, 33, was among those who spent her own money to put up apocalypse-themed billboards in Colorado and later met her husband while passing out Bible tracts in Japan. The pair traveled through Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, and Iraq to publicize Camping's prophecy and spent May 21st holed up in Montana waiting for the end. She said Thursday she was glad that the Christian preacher had acknowledged he didn't know everything about the rapture. Sure, I was looking forward to it, but it's actually a blessing to reconnect with family and friends.
Well, that was a terrible plan on her part, because if the world ends and you're in Montana, how will you know?
Oh.
And there go the two listeners we had in Montana.
I imagine they're aware of the situation.
I would hope so.
Well, Shelley was saying earlier about, you know, is this a ploy kind of thing?
Well, maybe. It's.
I don't know that it's intended as a ploy.
Obviously, you know, he had to address it at some point.
Yeah.
And to be fair, you know, a lot of people are mocking the fact that it's taken him so long to say anything and that he was in hiding. But he had a stroke. So there was a reason for the absence of his response to the failure of the rapture.
So Russell should have slurred his announcement slightly more.
More.
He wasn't?
I'm sorry. We shouldn't be laughing at the stroke of a 90-year-old man.
I was laughing at the bad impression of a 90-year-old man.
Okay.
So he had to say something, and when he failed in the early 90s, he just said, well, maybe I got something wrong, I'll have to go review, but this is happening, this is real, you can calculate it. This time around, after shifting to October and failing yet again, he's, rather than take the approach of, maybe I missed something, maybe, you know, we were just so effective in getting the word out there that God changed his mind and put things off, or, you know, any of the number of ways in which he could have spun it positively, he's gone to the other end and said, not only was I wrong, but it was sinful and blasphemous for me to, you know, in my hubris, make these predictions and assume that I could know. So he's completely reneged, which I think is a, you know, whether sincere or not, is going to be the best, you know, PR approach for his organization.
I think it's kind of sincere. I think it's the trained response. I mean, we saw it when Swaggart cried. We've seen it when, you know, Ted Haggard, you know, came out.
He's completely heterosexual.
Yes, he is completely heterosexual. The thing is, from that Christian mindset, it's kind of straightforward of when you've actually got it wrong, you can just admit that you were wrong and that it was a sin and acknowledge your sin. And this sort of redemption is common because it's like a built-in mechanism to get you back in the good graces of the people that you need to get back in good graces of.
One, to a large degree, it puts you in a better position than you would have been if you had not fucked up in the first place.
Well,
sometimes, yeah.
And there is nothing that anyone can do that is so bad that coming out and offering sincere profession of faith will not make people forgive them for it. I heard on the radio some years ago, like a guy, I forget which serial killer, but it was a well-known serial killer who was talking to like Focus on the Family or something. And they were sympathetic that when the news media came to talk to him, they just wanted to yak on about the murders and not about how great Jesus is.
Yeah.
That's the way it happens, and I can't help feeling that the kinds of people who followed Harold Camping will not learn a lesson from this, because they will localize it to say, oh, well, that Harold Camping guy was a false prophet. But the next guy who comes along, you know, Harold Camping's mistake was naming a date, right? All the rest is still true.
Yeah.
I mean, Tim LaHaye's still out there. He's actually started a new series that's like Left Behind Redux. This kind of thing is highly successful, and it doesn't hinge on the success of one individual's stupid predictions.
Yeah, it kind of makes me wonder. I mean, I know we you know, obviously we don't have the ability to replay time and take different paths and see what would have happened, but it seems like that there's basically two paths to being a recognized, prominent Christian. And one is to be on that route for the bulk of your life, or from whatever point you have this realization that Christianity is the shiznit, and then take off and keep going, build your following, and avoid making mistakes. The other one is to just be a somewhat regular individual who does something horrific or stupid that gets you notoriety, and then you catapult from that notoriety, or you use that notoriety as a platform to do a turnaround. I mean, you know, we've laughed before about the fact that, you know, if the economy takes an incredible downturn and I lose my job and I'm unemployed, the best way for me to make money at this point would be to turn to Jesus.
Hmm, they love you.
And start bilking all of the, you know, building a ministry, bilking people, you know, kind of playing off the fact that I've been evil for, you know, however long. I really don't know. I mean, I can't say whether the guy's legit or not. When he was wrong, he respun. He even respun this last time, but he did it kind of hedgingly and then had the stroke, and maybe the stroke was what he took as the hey, no, you got it wrong twice. You don't get to keep respinning. You know, the stroke was probably a message from God in his eyes. And so now it's, nope, I'm just a sinful reprobate, but I'm going to use the remaining 90 years of my life, because I'm pretty sure this guy's just going to live forever.
But maybe God's seen to it that now he can only lie out of one side of his mouth.
Oh. Oh, that's a win. He's going to be the next Methuselah. And anyway, before I start making fun of people with speech impediments and disabilities, and
okay,
that's the thing with Camping is that I kind of agree with Schilling. This might actually strengthen his radio ministry quite a bit.
Well, I think it necessarily will. Not necessarily stronger than it was before, but given the backlash that he's had, not only from his own people when it didn't happen, but from the entirety of the Christian community, you know, there was no potential for growth. With this, it basically puts him back into the fold, not only with his people, but with everybody else, as, you know, providing this great lesson.
Yeah, he's fallen kind of back more into the mainstream. It'd be kind of like Shirley Phelps if she stepped away from Westboro and said, you know, we got all this stuff wrong about God-hating fags, and we should have talked more about, you know, Jesus' love and everything else. And while he still considers homosexuality a sin, he actually loves these people, and he's not oppressing the United States. He's doing a powerful work in us and going to lift us. I'm, like, channeling right now, but she could be big.
Oh, yeah.
The second
she'd be
she
the
does
gold
it.
Mine to trot out of the conservative side for, we don't hate gay people. See, here's someone who did hate gay people who's changed their mind. So clearly we
not
can't
change their
be...
mind. God changed their heart.
Right.
God changed their heart. So what else have we
not
got?
Not seeing that happen with Shirley in particular.
Yeah, me neither. Oh, by the way, I won't read this whole email.
Yes.
But the guy we were talking about before replied while we were sitting here.
Oh, this
and,
don't guy? No.
So here's my quick note. I don't actually smoke. I'm in favor of legalization.
You know, we talked about him off air.
I know.
Okay.
I was saying that for your benefit, so you know where I was going. I don't actually smoke. I'm in favor of legalization. If you want to toke up, hey, you know, good for you. Do it safely, responsibly, whatever. But don't send me emails when you're baked, thinking that you've discovered the secrets of the universe. It's just a waste of both of our time. That it was, hey man, I've got this great secret. If you let me call into your show, I'll tell everybody and make it clear. Because so how can the brain be responsible for stuff when you know something we can see and touch? Correct. With that being said, the fact that we can see and touch our brain, and the fact that our brain interprets electrical signals to let you see basically everything we see is just perception. Wait, that makes no sense. If atheists are right, and we are only our bodies and brain, and we don't have a spirit soul, then how the F does those facts make any sense? How about this? Our spirit / soul is actually using our brain to perceive this reality. And so there was more with mixed, you know, full caps in there. And I sent back a quick explanation about identity and some potential problems to address. And what justification is there for a soul? And how do you know that that soul doesn't have a puppet master, which has a puppet master, which has a puppet master? But the other thing is when he said, atheism doesn't account for the fact that everything we see, hear, touch, smell, taste, or see are just electrical signals being sent to the brain. You're absolutely correct, because atheism isn't a theory of mind. It's a position on the existence of gods. It also doesn't explain why peanut butter is stickier than Astroglide. Any other irrelevancies you'd like to bring up while you're baked?
But shoot.
You keep getting pop-ups.
I was trying to cue a sound clip, but I have something else playing.
Oh.
I just wanted to play the Big Lebowski saying, that's like your opinion, man.
That's, yeah.
Oh, well, I blew that.
So, moving on from our baked callers, or authors.
A lesbian woman was denied communion at her mother's funeral. As her elderly mother was dying, Barbara Johnson lay next to her on the hospital bed, reciting the Hail Mary. Loetta Johnson, 85, had been a devout Catholic, raising her four children in the church and sending them to Catholic schools. At her mother's funeral mass at the St. John Newman Catholic Church in Gaithersburg, Maryland, a grieving Barbara Johnson was the first in line to receive communion. What happened next stunned her. The priest refused Johnson, who is gay, the sacramental bread and wine. He covered the bowl with the Eucharist with his hand and looked at me and said, I cannot give you communion because you live with a woman and that is a sin in the eyes of the church. Now, to me, this just highlights the need to separate the church from absolutely every important life event. That's why I have no patience with people who call us and say, why don't you just admit that marriage is a religious thing and not worry about equal rights for marriage and just not get married anymore. No, fuck you. Marriage, like funerals, is an interpersonal issue. And it's got nothing to do with religion. It's just religion that's been encroaching on this sort of thing. And I think her proper response would be, well, she shouldn't. I mean, I don't think they should have been having a Catholic funeral in the first place. And it doesn't matter if you get to eat a cracker, but damned if I would let some stupid priest humiliate me in front of my family. When it's my mother's funeral, not his.
Well, as to whether or not they should have had a Catholic funeral, I think
they were Catholic.
I don't think that should be her call. They should do what the mother, you know, if the mother was hardcore Catholic funeral makes perfect sense regardless of what the rest of the family believes. But at the same time, if you're, you know, entering into anything with an organization that you know doesn't like you, and I'm assuming she's Catholic, wanting communion. How could she have been shocked that the Catholics aren't so big on the lesbians?
I'm actually kind of confused when I read this, because hearing that somebody who would not be considered a doctrinal Orthodox member of the church was denied communion, not only does it not surprise me, I don't see what the objection is. I mean, when I was a Baptist, when we would have communion, which was the Lord's Supper, which was, I think, once a month, and we'd have grape juice and stale, tasteless crackers, it didn't even matter if you were a Christian. That within the Baptist church, it was for members of that church. So the members would get to participate, but not the guests. When it comes to things like communion, from the Catholic perspective, this is a sacred rite for Catholics, and only in the case of Catholics, only for those Catholics who are currently, you know, supposedly right with God, that they've done confessional and things. And I might be getting bits and pieces of it wrong because I wasn't Catholic. But for me, for somebody to say, I was at my mother's funeral and they refused to give me communion, tough shit. I mean, really, you don't have any right, and we don't have any right to force a church to do communion for somebody who they feel isn't deserving of their sacred right.
Maybe she believed herself to be Catholic. I mean, you know, the, well, the
she
rules.
Needs to take that up with her priests.
Well, but it's her mom's priest. You know, this story has gotten picked up largely by non-Catholics. But there is something to be said for it within Catholics, because from my understanding, a number of Catholic authorities have been sort of split on this, on, yes, homosexuality is sinful, but when it comes to a funeral, that's not how our policy goes. And so it has sort of highlighted some confusion about internal policy regarding funerals, but that's nothing more than a policy decision. It has nothing to do with... you know, her sexuality or her standing in the church, really. It's just, you know, bureaucracy, basically.
I mean, you know, I'm in complete agreement that the entire right is absurd and silly. Right. And I wasn't a fan of the HuffPo article that did the cannibalism thing, because I think it's correct. Don't get me wrong. It's correct. If you believe in transubstantiation, then yeah, cannibalism is on board. But it's... There's a difference here. There's a difference in what's going on from the point of view of the imbibers, I guess.
Well, I think the problem comes in when you use the unwarranted authority that the church has gotten to bully people politically. I mean, it's very similar to back in 2004 when there was this big deal about how some Boston church was not going to let John Kerry have communion because of his stance on abortion. And, you know, that is sort of picking and choosing which principle they want, because officially the Catholic Church is also against the death penalty, but you don't see any Republicans being denied communion for
That's their right.
We have no right. I think the thing is that people should stop giving this unwarranted power to these churches.
Oh, absolutely. They won't. Mm-hmm. I mean, this kind of, I don't necessarily want to jump right off the subject, but it definitely segues into the Freedom for Religion Foundation advertisement, which we can get to in just a couple seconds.
Okay.
When the church denied John Kerry communion, that's them mostly making a political statement. Unfortunately, it falls in that area where, okay, that's just what's going to happen.
Maybe, though, but he had such a high profile that giving him communion would also have sent a political message.
Yeah.
So no matter what decision they made, it was going to be political. So I don't think one can really make a case that they're motivated purely by politics. Because,
well, my understanding is it's an unusual step to actually deny somebody communion. I mean, I mean, John Kerry is a professing Catholic and has been receiving communion for years and years. So if they, on this particular occasion, said, not today, you can't have communion because we're making a statement about abortion.
Yeah.
That is, you know, attempting to kick him in the nuts.
Yeah, I think that's the more, denying is the more extraordinary of the two, given the circumstances involved. But I definitely think a political statement is going to be made either way. It's just the nature of the beast. But at the end of the day, because of the First Amendment, and because it's the right thing to do, we have to allow them to, you know, be petty about their little rituals as much as they want to.
Yeah.
And hopefully they get ridiculous enough about it that it pisses people off and people no longer want to support them.
And that's certainly what the Freedom From Religion Foundation is banking on when they took out a half-page ad in the New York Times this week saying, it's time to consider quitting the Catholic Church. Now, that wasn't over the funeral. I believe this was about the Catholic Church's increasingly ridiculous position birth control is just sinful.
Yeah.
And they should have the right to block people from birth control. It's time to quit the Roman Catholic Church. Will it be reproductive freedom or back to the Dark Ages? Do you choose women and their rights or bishops and their wrongs? Whose side are you on? In light of the U.S. Catholic Conference of Bishops' war against women's rights to contraception, why are you aiding and abetting a church that has repeatedly engaged in a crusade to ban contraception, abortion, and sterilization, to deny the right of all women everywhere, Catholic or not, to decide whether and when to become mothers? Think of the acute misery, poverty, needless suffering, unwanted pregnancies, overpopulation, social evils, and deaths that can be laid directly at the door of your church's pernicious doctrine that birth control is a sin and must be outlawed. If you think you can change the church from within, get it to lighten up on birth control, gay rights, marriage equality, embryonic stem cell research, you're deluding yourself. By remaining a good Catholic, you are doing bad to women's rights. You are an enabler, and it's got to stop.
Now, I feel the need to call you on starting off with a straw man. And it's the straw man that I think has dominated the left's end of this conversation.
All right, bring it.
They're not trying to block women's access to birth control. They're trying not to have a mandate to have insurance that covers it. And that's a huge difference.
Okay, when it was private insurance, Catholic churches all over the place were just buying the insurance, and they weren't trying to pick and choose a laundry list of items off of what insurance is supposed to cover. Birth control has been standard for insurance companies for a long time, and Catholics are just thinking that they can wield this leverage now that there's an additional government role in the insurance business.
So, I see what Chilling's saying, and I've had conversations about this kind of thing before, and when we talk about to the letter of what they're doing, mm-hmm. you're right. It's not about blocking access to contraception. But we talk about the effects. So the argument that I used to make is, I don't know, I can't say what's in their heart and what their goals are. If they're actually trying to prevent women from having access to contraception or trying to prevent women from having access to abortion, I can just talk about what they're actually proposing, the consequences of it, and the fact that they don't seem to care or that they're okay with those consequences. However, in this case, with regard to contraception, when you have Rick Santorum out there as a Roman Catholic, gaining in the polls, in the GOP primaries...
You want the quote?
Whose position is that contraception and access to contraception promotes this libertine sexual freedom that is destroying our world, and he wants contraception gone, and that as president he would make this an issue, I think I can say something at least about his motivations and the people that are aligning themselves with
his, certainly. But I think that in the discussion, both sides are alienating each other and just speaking to their own crowds. And a big part of it is I've spoken with a number of people and read a number of arguments that aren't anti-birth control, but they're from a fiscal conservative standpoint. And I'm a fiscal conservative, but I'm not really behind their argument. But they have a problem with the government mandating that they get the insurance that covers this. That's what they have a problem with.
But they have a problem with the insurance in its entirety. And they're picking out birth control because they think that this is a useful, divisive issue to play people's religious prejudices.
In the case of contraception, we know it saves lives, it saves money, it costs us less in the long run. I mean, that's just just the way it works, which is why when the Obama administration originally proposed this and the church started to cry foul, their initial complaint was, no, you're making us, getting rid of the copay is making us pay for it, and that's a problem. So Obama, which I think was a horrible mistake, but I was okay with it, made a compromise, which was, okay, you're not going to have to pay for this. The insurance company's going to pay for it. And the insurance companies are happy to pay for it because it saves them money. So from a fiscal conservative standpoint, it's the smart thing to do.
Sort of. And that's why I'm certainly behind it, you know, in my position as a bit of a fiscal conservative. But there's also the more long-term idea of the level of involvement the government is going to have in these types of decisions for employers. I don't have a problem with this call, but I don't think that it's entirely unreasonable for someone to have trepidation, even if they think it's a damn good idea, even if they think that this should be standard procedure. They don't want it coming from the federal government. They want it coming from, you know, business trends and what's going to become dominant of its own in the market.
But then we're back to what Russell was saying, basically, that they're objecting to the whole and they're using this part as their focus for an objection.
Yeah, I mean, it's two separate arguments that are getting dishonestly conflated with each other.
I see a lot of libertarians and conservatives and things like that who, you know, don't want the Affordable Care Act and don't want government mandated anything. And I see their arguments, but since we already have it, and since preventive care has to be covered, there's no excuse for not, for saying that birth control is not preventive care. And there's no excuse for all this slut shaming and stuff that's going on. I don't see very many of the conservatives and libertarians talking much about it. What I see with the Catholics talking about it is that it is about birth control.
The Catholics are a really small part of the conversation, though. Like, I saw an interesting media analysis that was pointing out that, you know, we have this idea of it being the Catholics, but they've become a small part. The evangelicals and the fiscal conservatives, especially the religious ones, they're really dominating a lot of the conversation. Now, we point to Catholics because of Santorum and because of their history of it.
But because of the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Not because of Catholic women, who are 98% on birth control.
Right.
My thing is, this is comparable to the discussion about marriage equality, when I have atheists or secularists who are also libertarian, because when I say that I haven't seen any valid secular arguments that are against gay marriage, and I'm talking about in a world where marriage is permitted, and they come back and they say, no, I'm opposed to gay marriage because I don't think the government should be
marriage.
in the marriage business. And I'm like, okay, that's not an argument against gay marriage. That's an argument against marriage.
Or an argument against discrepancy between gay and heterosexual marriage.
Yeah. And so they're like, no, I don't want gays to get married because that's more marriages, and my goal is to limit the number of marriages. Well, all right, first of all, fuck you, because if you can't discuss this within the specific terms, we have a world in which the government is involved in marriage. If you want to get the government out of marriage, fine. I might even agree with you on that. I think there's some potentially good cases. I think that, you know, these may be antiquated ideas. Why does the government have to sanction this? Why do Beth and I get a tax break now? I mean, what changed about our relationship apart from we had a big fucking party?
Why did my car insurance shoot up when I got divorced?
Yes. What is this? But what we're talking about is equality. And your point was, Schilling, was great in that we're talking about you haven't come up with a justification for the disparity between the two.
Right, and that's always my argument, because I'd prefer the government out of marriage. Yeah. Marriage, the benefits are nothing that you can't get through contract law.
Except for the tax
contract
break.
Contract law is government.
Except for the tax break.
Right, and the tax break I don't think should be there. It's basically the government trying to buy your lifestyle.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, when you say through contract law, contracts are enforced because we have courts, which are government.
Yes, but that doesn't make contract law government.
I mean, the fact that government is involved in marriage just basically means that marriage is a great big contract that government has decided to enforce.
But it's not enforced in the same way as first.
It's not just enforcing contracts. It's saying which contracts can't be enforced, and that's the problem. Okay. At least that's the potential problem.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
It's saying we're going to enforce these contracts, but we're not going to enforce these contracts.
Right.
And the objection is to why it's picking one over the other. And so if you, I agree that if we just switched it to contracts, that you'd still have the government actually enforcing them, but now it would be a strict matter of law rather than government bureaucracy and agents trying to determine things. It'd be a matter for the courts.
Sure.
And if marriage equality, every time marriage equality becomes a matter of the courts, marriages become equal.
Right, and the government would be involved when there's breach of contract or suspected breach of contract. As it stands, they're involved every step of the way. As soon as you're married, the government is involved.
Now, I don't know what my position is on this. I've heard good arguments on both sides, but my point is, you know, when we're talking about marriage,
it's either going to be both or neither.
Yeah.
That's kind of the point.
That's
and
it.
Similarly, when it comes to contraception, you know, the problem that happens is that, you know, government is a great big purchaser now of insurance. And if they say we're not, you know, we're going to let these individual religious groups decide what the insurance groups can offer, that doesn't wind up just affecting government insurance. I mean, you know, that doesn't just wind up affecting people who are insured via the new healthcare plan. It also affects everybody who is on these plans by companies which are no longer allowed in many cases to offer contraception as something they cover.
Yeah, Beth's point was absolutely right, and that is that we can have all kinds of discussions legitimately about whether or not we're going to cover preventative care. But if we are going to cover preventative care, then there shouldn't be any discussion really about whether or not contraception counts. At least I don't see any valid discussion about whether or not contraception counts as preventive care. It seems like almost a no-brainer. But when we're talking about, you know, the religious liberty aspect of this, it's incredibly frustrating. There's a guy at work I was talking to who made the comment, you know, what's next, Catholic accounting firms? I mean, we have a situation, and I don't mean to just pick on the Catholics, because Mormons and Baptists and others, they all own secular businesses outside mm-hmm. of the church. It has nothing to do with what their religious... In the case where they own charities or universities, they can be loosely tied to their religious goals of, you know, we're here to educate people or help people or, you know, whatever. But there's nothing about a university or a charity that is necessarily tied to a religion. This is where religious organizations have jumped out of the bounds of their church and established other businesses. And if they're going to compete in that market, and I'm glad to have them do it. I mean, we would probably have fewer hospitals and fewer universities if it weren't for these organizations. But if they can't do it within the bounds of the law, if they can't render under Caesar that which is Caesar's, as their Bible tells them to do, then they need to get the fuck out of that business. Just like a pharmacist who cannot, for religious convictions, dispense medicine that a doctor's prescribed, should not be allowed to be a pharmacist. And if you're going to run a hospital and say, well, and the point that I made on the show a week ago was, even if this was about religious liberty, and it's not, the church's position is that the religious views of the corporation that owns this business trump the religious views of their employees, and that's just wrong.
But unfortunately, there's recent court precedent for that. There was a case, it was a Christian, I believe, high school, and a woman had to take medical leave for temporary disability, and when she got back, they had fired her. And this is in direct conflict with the ADA. So she sued to get her job back for, you know, discriminatory firing. Mm-hmm. And the courts decided to go with the church's argument, which was, despite the fact that she's a math teacher and not an official with the church in any way, and she's simply an employee, the church decided all of its teachers count as ministers.
Yeah. I think that case was decided wrongly in this ministerial exception. Here's the thing. Churches are tax-free organizations in the United mm-hmm. States, and they have had special treatment forever, despite the First Amendment, and in part because of the First Amendment. We have a hands-off thing when it comes to religions and religious organizations. And so from there, they have branched out like fucking weeds and into all sorts of other enterprises.
Right.
And everywhere they go, they bring along the baggage of their religious liberties and their religious freedom.
In fact,
and we
largely,
should have drawn a line long ago.
Largely, the reason why they've gotten into, they've managed to get their paws into so many areas is because they are, in many cases, exempt from a lot of the rules.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if we've got regulation, maybe you, Schilling, would say that some of these regulations need to go away. But if they're there, it's a big problem if they're unequally enforced. And, you know, if an organization is able to thrive because they get a free pass on a lot of regulations, and basically manage to get anti-competitive that way, you know, you have schools which are allowed to get away with a lot of stuff, and you have, like, you know, the massive number of Catholic schools in the country where people from many areas often think that the alternatives are so bad, I have no choice but to subject my kid to a Catholic school. Mm-hmm. Because I, you know, there are literally no other alternatives around.
Well, to be fair, a lot of people go to Catholic schools because a lot of Catholic schools are just damn good schools.
Yeah.
You know, they're bad on science and things like that now and then.
Not even always that.
Yeah. But by and large, private Catholic schools, perhaps because of the history of them, tend to be really well-performing schools. And there are a lot of people who, even if there are great public schools available, if they have the opportunity to get into that Catholic school, they will.
I think what's happened is we've the leash analogy maybe isn't perfect, so you'll excuse me, but we've given them such a long leash because by and large they were doing good things. They were doing charities and hospitals and universities and contributing to society. It was the only way in which we could demonstrate that religions were actually contributing to society, because a church isn't, you know, in and of itself. I don't see the contribution there. But we, by being lax about this and allowing them to carry this special treatment everywhere they go, and I'm not, you know, this isn't a doom and gloom thing, but I'm wondering, is there anything to prevent us from eventually living in a country where all businesses are owned by the church, operating independent of government regulations?
When the way the regulations are set up, it puts the courts in an awkward position because the necessary legislation isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
While I agree that the case we discussed was incorrect in its result, it did put the court in a position of having to define for the church,
yes,
what counts as a minister. But what really bothered me about the case, though, was even if they're right and they're exempt from the ADA, their constituents or, you know, their adherents should have raised hell about the fact that they violated it anyway. You shouldn't be forced not to discriminate against the disabled.
Yeah. Not only are we in this really strange predicament where there is this favoritism and there is this confusion about the rules and it puts courts in an awkward position, but the courts, the United States government is always in the position of sanctioning religions because you have to be approved by the government on the approved religion list in order to qualify for your tax exemption. So the government is constantly in this position of saying, you're a religion, you're not, you're a religion, you're not. And like Scientology had to fight for years before the United States government would recognize them. Right. For me, it's really simple. Let's let everybody who wants to say they're a religion be a religion. And let's give absolutely none of them any sort of special treatment with regard to government stuff, especially taxes, etc. And let them all qualify as 501c3s or whatever they want when they make a demonstration that they qualify, you know, because they're doing charitable work or whatever. And you don't get to own any business beyond your church unless you agree to follow every federal legislation. You shouldn't get preferential treatment over a secular business owner. If I want to open Matt's Drink and Fuck down the street, and the Catholic Church wants to open a Drink and Fuck as well,
I'd pick the Catholic one.
There's no reason why should be saddled with paying for insurance and following regulations that this other Drink and Fuck doesn't, because it puts them in an unfair advantage for business, and it also puts their employees at a potential disadvantage. Plus, my Drink and Fuck, way better.
But even then, on the nuanced level, there's difficulty determining profitable enterprise from some of the nonprofit status. You know, a lot of churches don't really have a proper store, but they have like a little bookstore. You know, they'll sell books from that. Maybe if something's successful, they have these other things where it's hard to determine the line between fundraising and profitable enterprise. And currently the legislation does a terrible job of trying to, you know, have offering the demarcation between the two. And that's something that we really need is a determination of where the line is into profitable enterprise.
I was getting ready to say something, and then while I was still listening to you, I realized just how potentially wrong what I was going to say was. And that is, when I was in Houston, I went to Joel Osteen's church, and they have a huge, well, all right, huge, probably, it's a good-sized bookstore within the church itself. And they sell all sorts of Christian books and paraphernalia and wall hangings and DVDs and toys and stuff. I mean, it's a little miniature family Christian store.
Right.
Is what it is. And I was basically going to say, you know, I got no problem with that. I'm not so sure, because what's to keep them from adding a wing onto that church as part of the church that's the, you know, Joel Osteen Financial Management Company, you know?
Well, there's a Catholic church in London. I forget the name of it, unfortunately. It's the most prominent one there is, as far as I know. But, you know, like the Occupy people were protesting out in front of it, and the church objected because it was costing them money, and apparently they make £16,000 a day selling shit.
Yeah.
Like, there are checkout counters in this church, and so they're selling shit all the time, and at £16,000 a day... I'm pretty sure that's profitable enterprise,
even though it's in a church.
I think that a very reasonable concern that drives fiscal conservatives and libertarians is the worry that a government unchecked by any other entity, given unlimited power, will grow and become a terrifying dictatorship over everyone. Where I think that fiscal conservatism is sometimes hesitant to acknowledge is that there are other large, scary powers besides governments.
I think that you're conflating fiscal conservatism and anti-government sentiment.
Okay. Well, they do often in many people go hand in hand.
Yeah. For example, Tea Party folk.
Right.
Yeah. Hand in hand there, but it's two issues that they happen to share.
So when the government is doing its job properly with regulation, its effect is to sort of rein in the other scary powers, like corporations can become the company store where they keep people de facto enslaved, like happened after abolition of slavery, and the church can grow out of control so that suddenly one day we wake up and we find that we've got all these hospitals that somehow, you know, 75% of them are Catholic, and all of a sudden they've decided that they're outlawing abortion, or they're saying that only that gay people can't have heart surgery
one day. But not every right thing should necessarily come from the government. There are some changes that need to be made by the government and some changes that need to be made by society.
Right.
For me, my fiscal conservatism is largely one of the principle of the issue at hand. For example, Austin has a smoking ban.
Mm-hmm.
I abort. I think it's a terrible law.
I'm not even sure I'm into this.
And I think it's horridly unethical. It should be the business owner's choice. Now, that being said, I, as a heavy smoker, if I'm going to a restaurant to eat decent food, I like it when the owner bans smoking inside, because I have no problem with secondhand smoke, you know, when I'm breathing it, but I want to taste my food.
Yeah.
But it should always be the owner's decision. Or, you know, the city of Austin recently has decided to ban disposable bags, plastic bags, paper bags, things like that, for the environment. It was about
Austin?
A week ago. Yeah. In about 1 year, you won't be able to get a plastic bag when you go get a couple drinks at the convenience store.
Wow.
When you go to the grocery store, you've got to bring all that canvas shit. So there are a lot of
wow,
weird areas, the trans fat bans that are sweeping the country.
On that.
Yeah.
But,
so yeah. I haven't smoked cigarettes in probably it's 3 years and some change now. And I'm opposed to the smoking ban because I think it violates the rights of business owners. And what we saw happen was immediately after the smoking ban went into effect, there were three or four pool halls that closed down.
Mm-hmm.
There's certain types of businesses where people are much more likely to smoke. Bars.
Cigar bars have to close unless, you know,
they do the membership thing.
yeah, some of them were able to convert to private membership, but not all of them can do that, obviously, because if you're a cigar smoker, you're not going to, you know, join membership and pay fees to go to all of them. But a lot of them had to close because there is a line between what portion of your sales have to come from tobacco products before you get the cigar bar exemption. But it's a cigar bar. People are going to spend more on drinks than on cigars, even if they're chain smoking.
Yeah. Even if they brought in the most expensive good cigars. I mean, people just aren't going to buy those necessarily. Right. You know, it's I want my, you know, Portofino or whatever, and I'm going to sit here and enjoy it while I have some, well, in my case, John Walker Black or
tequila
or something.
But I do think that I've kind of inadvertently steered this pretty far away from atheism.
Yeah, it really did. And that's okay, though.
But it may have been something we needed to hash out.
Getting back to this, my thinking on this is that the first thing we need to address when we're dealing with this kind of constant, when we're starting to pull the weeds up, is we need to start with hospitals. And I have a friend who works at a hospital, who has a Catholic hospital, who's told me some absolutely crazy stories about what they put some people through in order to conform to their religious views, including having burial services for placentas in abrupted births.
Oh,
the thing is, people don't really always have a choice about what hospital they go to. I mean, not even just the case when you're 911 and an ambulance is taking you. You're going to go to the hospital that's nearest you quite often. And it's not easy, even for private businesses, to just say, oh, we don't like your Catholic hospital over there, so we're going to put in a new hospital across the street that actually has, you know, full science-based medicine and no ridiculous stuff where we're going to bury people's placentas or have call in priests to counsel them instead of qualified counselors. You can't just do that. And I think it's the first area where we really need to tighten up, where there's, you know, possibly some changes in legislation. And the first thing that's going to happen is they're going to cry, oh, no, you're violating our religious liberty, just as they have with this contraception thing. And no, we're not. You're violating our secular liberties.
Well, I agree with you in that it's important, but I think it's more important to go after schools. Schools that are getting accreditation, that are religious, that are not teaching to adequate standards.
The thing is, we already have public schools.
Yes.
I'm in favor of improving our public schools.
But even then, we've talked a lot about homeschooling and their complete lack of standards.
Yeah, I'm in favor of dramatically improving both public schools and homeschooling things. But it's not like any kids being forced. Well, kids may be
forced. Yeah, kids are, yeah.
It's not like any parent is forced to send their kids to a religious school.
No, but
they may be forced to send them to a religious hospital.
The children don't.
Oh, I understand.
So they have fewer options than one has about a hospital.
I'm just saying that my kids, nobody's going to send them to a religious school other than me. I may be forced to take them to a religious hospital, which is why it's potentially a bigger deal. And the fact that religious, you know, schools are often good. Anyway, we're way afoul of what we talked about. What's next?
I don't know. Are we almost done?
I don't know. Did you have a news bit?
Well, I mean, you know, Alain de Botton.
Yeah.
Opened his mouth again.
Man, we got a lot of
month.
Email about that.
Yeah. I'm not sure. Some people must have been sending it to us approvingly, because it's like, we get some mail that's like, hey, did you hear what this guy said? What do you think?
Yeah, I actually wrote either a blog post or a note on Facebook explaining what I thought.
Yeah. Well, that was a couple months ago, but then he opened his mouth again and Martin handled this one.
Well, I didn't get the email, so might one of you like to fill people in on
he's got this new book called Religion for Atheists, and he's given this TED talk.
Oh, he's the
about,
atheism 2.0.
Yeah,
asshole.
Now you remember.
Okay.
See how easy that was? The atheism 2.0 asshole. Here's the thing. My quick take was, I'm all in favor of taking good where we find it, including religions. The religions do plenty of good things and have some good ideas about things, because it's people. I mean, what religions do are what people do, and we come up with stuff.
Yeah.
So let's keep the good and get rid of the bad. But what this guy's advocating is...
He's basically saying that you're incapable of producing or appreciating good music or architecture without having a religious framework. And so let's have a religious framework so we can have nice things too.
Yeah, he wants to add like ritual and, I mean, you know, let's have some ritual stuff like this. Why? Well, his argument is that this is the way people learn, by rote repetition, and, you know, and he's right. I still remember the Schoolhouse Rock stuff. I still remember the songs they taught me on the Vacation Bible School bus. Up until recently, I could quote you the Joys of the Spirit because of a little memory mnemonic thing that they taught us at VBS, but I've forgotten most of those now, or the Gifts of the Spirit, sorry. My point is that, yes, if you want people to know a fact, rote repetition is the way, but I'm not convinced that that's a way to understanding, which is what my goal is. You know, yes, you could create a whole bunch of little atheist robots who go in and feel happy and and you know, maybe they'll sing songs.
Jesus
and
doesn't love me.
You know, maybe they'll pass around you know, I don't know, a joint or something. But
his end, you know, his conclusion is complete horseshit. But I think that his approach to the situation is just as bad. If you're trying to improve things...
I love the but in that sentence. Thank you.
If you're trying to improve things... Well, I think that the idea of wanting to improve solidarity and communication within the atheist community, that's fair enough. That could be admirable. But you don't look around and see what's sitting around that we could use. You build... from the ground up, you figure, what do we need as a community? What's the best way of going about that? Not, well, this thing over here kind of sort of approximated, so let's just borrow that.
I don't think I agree.
You go ahead.
I don't think I agree, because I think it's a good idea to look around and see what's available that you can make use of.
Well, certainly take influence, but yeah, not okay. Just, you know, borrow this and stick it here with a little modification.
Like, you can be influenced by, let's say, C.S. Lewis as a children's author without going into the whole let's have a Jesus metaphor in there, for instance.
Yeah.
I mean,
I still have the books. I think his goals and my goals are different, and that's fine. He can have different goals, but the kind what he wants atheists and atheism to be, I don't want any part of it.
Right.
Here's the big annoyance I have with Alain de Botton, and he seems to be part of this bandwagon of people who are saying, I'm an atheist, but I'm one of those nice atheists who doesn't criticize religion very much. In fact, I mean, you know, in a way, he's sort of a more moderate version of S.E. Cup, right? You know, I have a lot of love for what religion is. And while this sounds open-minded and nice, you know, what they're actually doing is telling atheists like us, who do go on at great lengths about the problems that we have about religion, they would say to people like us, essentially, don't be a dick. And it's like, I want to be a dick, and I think I can empirically demonstrate that often being a dick is productive. It addresses those problems directly. And I don't have a problem with Alain de Botton saying, I'm not going to be a dick, and I'd like it if you guys follow my example. But when he takes it as far as saying, no approach but mine will work, we've got to become more like religions, and people who are rude to religious people should just shut up and stop it.
Even if he was right that no approach but his would work, which I don't know that he's necessarily asserted that quite that strongly.
Yeah,
but even if he was right, okay, then it won't work. Because, I mean, you know, I don't want to straw man him, but I will just a smidgen, and that is the measure of his ideas was this: I want to build a big, towering, black, atheist temple.
Yeah.
for us to go to. I mean, you know, Eye of Sauron
thing,
and everything.
I think we should take advice from that guy on how on what architecture looks good.
Yeah. You know,
it's the stupidest idea.
Hey, we're the friendly atheists, and we've just built this god-awful huge black tower in your town.
Can we have simulated lightning clouds over it?
Yeah, as if you know.
And vultures.
No, just the creationists will certainly be protesting, and I just envision this huge black monolith with a bunch of creationists swinging around signs of
okay, maybe he's got a point.
As far as you know, trying to make oneself more palatable through this, you know, trying the centrist approach of I'm one of the good ones, is annoying, but it can be seen all over the place. And this idea of concessions that really counter one's point. You know, I'm in the Tea Party, but I'm not racist. I'm a feminist, but I'm not anti-porn. You know, there's legitimate room to make some distinctions, but it becomes a common thing of trying to sort of minimize whatever baggage comes with your label that you don't like. And it's not always illegitimate, but the extent to which he does it is just kind of dickish.
The disagreement comes in because what he thinks of as baggage, I think of as an extremely positive feature of atheist activism.
Yeah, baggage wasn't necessarily used negatively there.
Well, but he does.
Yeah. But I think perhaps a good example of this is, you know, I don't want to get into the Limbaugh thing too much, but I saw a great article that was taking to task a portion of Fluke's supporters because, you know, she was called a slut. And there was a lot of outcry of, no, she's a law student. She's not a slut. She's doing all these great things. She was talking about birth control for non-sexual use, for treatment, all this stuff. And this article was making a point of, so what if she was a slut?
And yes, I agree with
they're
that.
They're sort of alienating the fact that the less acceptable possibility is, you know, somehow less worthy of defense. And I think it's just a tactic to make one's argument more palatable and avoid what would be the more effective approach in terms of actually getting shit done.
Amanda Marcotte actually made a very similar point, and I don't think we've... I mean, I just want to give minimal background on this for people who listen in 5 years. But Rush Limbaugh, or a law student went up and said, you know, birth control is expensive and there's no reason why it shouldn't be covered by standard health insurance. And Rush Limbaugh went off on this 3-day-long rant about how she's a huge slut and she just wants people to pay for her to have sex, and then she should make videotapes so we can watch it because I'm paying for it and blah, blah, blah. First of all, Rush Limbaugh is in no position to be calling people a slut, Mr. Sneaking Across the Border with Viagra.
I disagree with that having much in the way of relevance.
All right, fine.
There are plenty of reasons to go there outside of sexual tourism, and I think that all the snarky little implications just make people look silly.
All right.
If you have no evidence for it, just leave it as it is.
Evidence for the Viagra thing?
No, evidence for, you know, all these implications surrounding, well, why was he in a country known for sexual tourism with Viagra? I think that stuff's just silly, and Rush is a big enough dick that there's stuff you can prove about him
that is
just as bad.
The point Amanda Marcotte was making was that people are getting obsessed with trying to say that this really isn't about sex in a way that minimizes the importance and value of sex. Saying, oh, no, they're not all, you know, not everyone is taking birth control for getting laid. They could be, you know, they could need it for health problems. And that's true, and that's legitimate, but it also sort of buys into this framework that that sex is dirty and evil and something that should be opposed.
And maybe someone can answer this for me.
That was similar to the point you were making,
I'm
actually.
Not certain if those arguments are even necessarily relevant. I've spoken to women who can get birth control covered by their insurance, But if it's prescribed to them as a treatment for, say, endometriosis, their insurance won't cover it because then it's off-label use. So it's a dicey issue as to whether or not, you know, some of these medical uses that are legitimate and should be covered, even if the insurer had to cover preventative care, I don't know where it would fall, because they'll get out of things for off-label use as often as they can.
I'm dying to hear from Beth on this. I know that.
Well, that's kind of funny what
you
said, because I know of a lot of people actually, even at Georgetown University, which Sandra Fluke was talking about, they're supposed to allow contraception and cover contraception for medical use. It's just in practice very hard to get a doctor to say that it's for medical use.
Right.
So that's very interesting.
But even, you know, it's one of those things where she, well, the woman to whom I was speaking, she said that she, you know, she wasn't on the pill for birth control. She got a prescription for her endometriosis and the insurance would not cover it. So she waited a few weeks and then she went to, you know, the clinic and got prescribed birth control for birth control. And then they covered it because then it wasn't this off-label use. Now, things may have changed since she did this because the labeled usage and what the FDA has strictly approved as use, you know, is always changing and things are being added. But I'm not sure where it lies on the insurance.
Mm-hmm. Well, it shouldn't be a game to get birth control for any use. I mean, it's safe, it's effective, it should be covered, it's preventative care.
I mean, it reduces overpopulation, it reduces diseases. Those are all health positive things when they are used as directed for fucking.
Yeah. I don't even know why we're talking about this, but yes, the Amanda Marcotte's point, yes, if Rush Limbaugh is going to call this woman a slut, we're all sluts. Then 99% of all women in the U.S. are sluts.
Yeah, and that's what.
Good news, folks. You heard it here first on the nonprofits. 98% of women are sluts. Curiously, awesome. I bet 98% of men are sluts, too.
I bet 99.5.
All right.
But, you know, thanks to all you slut listeners for continuing to support us.
This is one of the slut nonprofits. Yeah, I was probably guilty of the slut-shaming stuff maybe in my teen years. Maybe. I mean, I had a completely different mindset at the time that was, you know, predicated on religious ideas about morality. And also, you know, I was in high school. And so there were the girls who were sluts. And this was also quite a few years ago. And they, you know, there was a reputation there that, you know, was clearly, it wasn't necessarily so much that it was negative. It's that it was good gossip. It was something for people to talk about. Because quite honestly, some of the sluttier girls in school weren't necessarily the least popular. And they weren't necessarily shunned. It was, oh yeah, you know, she... It was a lot of backstabbing kind of between women on occasions. I didn't object to somebody being a slut other than, you know, that they were a sinful harlot. Now, you know, it's here we are in 2012 and we're back to talking about, you know, stuff Loretta Lynn sang about 50, 60 years ago. And We're making accusations. It wasn't so much even that he called her a slut. I think that as soon as he called her a prostitute, she probably had legal action when he misrepresented what she was actually testifying to. I think she had. I hope she sues him, you know, and takes half his shit.
It'd be a difficult lawsuit.
It would kind of be difficult.
Demonstrate damages, it'd be...
Well, especially since she's actually probably kind of benefited from it.
Right.
I mean, she's got a firm representing her now for, you know, people wanting her to speak. So you're right about...
But I think people need to be wary of the slut-shaming that's going on in reaction to this statement. Now, we're not there yet. And women that I've spoken to are not all in one camp or another as far as the idea of, you know, reducing the stigma attached to the word slut and making it a neutral adjective or sorry, a neutral noun. You know, there are a lot of women, like the slut walk, for example. Now, it could go the way of, for example, queer, where, you know, 50 years ago, you say, you're such a queer, and that was very derogatory, and that's largely how it would be taken. But there was a process of sort of reclaiming the term, and now the response, even if it's in animosity, you know, you're a queer, and?
I mean, like many people in the gay, in the, you know, LGBT community now refer to each other as queer, and, or even use queer as a blanket term to cover all those things that LGBT encompasses.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said for taking ownership of the term, you know. I mean, liberals did it a little bit. I think atheists are doing it now. With a lot of terms, godless, heathen, yeah, you know, whatever.
I like kafir, personally.
I like faker for the other side, though. I'm a kafir and you're a faker. But, yeah, there's a lot to be said about possibly owning the term, but there's also, you know, a benefit to kind of moving beyond the terms. Like, what business of yours is it? How promiscuous I am or am not?
Yeah, but it's so rare that you see them challenged of just say, okay, if she's a slut, where does the problem with that lie? And
yeah,
pin them down to, you know, the probability that they're just prudish about sex.
Not even just prudish. Quite often the problem is just flat hypocrisy, that you stand a man and a woman next to each other and you have them list out the number and frequency of their sexual encounters, and the men in the audience and even some of the women will be admiring the virile stallion who's out doing his, you know, duty to spread his seed, and they'll, you know, revile the harlot standing next to him type thing.
Yeah, and so, there, I mean, you know, you don't have to grow up religious to run into that. I mean, lots of movies in popular culture, despite the fact that Hollywood is supposed to be full of all this debauchery, I mean, there is an actual trope, which I've got up here, sex is evil, where you know, the shy, demure girl who isn't sexy is the one that the hero is supposed to wind up with, and the evil one is the one who wants to fuck his brains out.
Not only that, but the first ones to die in horror movies are the ones, the kids that are, if there's two kids having sex at the beginning of a horror flick, they're dead.
Yeah. But there's, well, that's often pointed out, but in a way that is so thoroughly oversimplified, because yeah, when you examine the tropes of horror, it's a process of the protagonist being meek and mild and going through all this shit and then coming out confident. If she was getting laid every other weekend and having a great time,
no character,
she'd have the confidence already.
All right. Have we got any last bits we want to throw in now that we've talked about everything? And we got to sex again, which we should make that like a rule.
Yeah,
we can't do the nonprofits without talking about sex.
In fact, since Jeff D has stopped doing the show regularly, there has been a disturbing lack of truly tasteless comments. He used to pride himself for saying, that was my truly tasteless comment for the episode. We need more of that.
That's why Schilling's here.
Oh. I take that back.
I haven't heard the truly tasteless comment yet today.
Schilling, take us out.
I don't do quotas, and I'm not your fucking monkey. Oh.
But I'm pumped. Grind it. I'm trying to think if there's any last thing we have to say. There is a TV show tomorrow called The Atheist Experience. It's live here in Austin, and it'll be hosted by Russell Glasser.
Hey-o.
South by Southwest is currently going on in Austin.
Oh, shit.
And, yes, all the Austinites that I know couldn't possibly care less and probably want to avoid downtown. But I did get a chance to go downtown last night because Ashley Paramore from SSA was in town briefly, and we got to visit a bit. And there's lots of good stuff going on with the SSA. One of the things that happened in Amarillo while I was there is, this is Texas A&M, or West Texas A&M. They don't have a Secular Student Alliance group. And the closest SSA group was Lubbock. And when I got there, there were some communication problems, and so there wasn't an SSA rep there. There wasn't anybody to hand anything out. We tried to get a hold of the Lubbock group to get them to come over and participate and maybe hand out some flyers. And it didn't quite gel, and so I used a little piece of the debate to push the SSA. And fortunately, there were three or four students that came up afterwards that were like, we want to do this. And I used what little authority I have to say, no, you guys have to do this. And you got to start right now and send me an email. And here's the information you need. Get with the SSA because it's going to allow you to do more of these things. And it's going to allow you to reach out to the other students that were sitting along the edge of the wall over here while the mostly Christian audience was, applauding for sophistry. And they were sitting over there waiting and you know, trying to clap when I'd say something. Get all those people involved. You can do more things like this. So that's my shameless plug for the SSA today. We're not sure about the schedule. We're back. And I have one speaking engagement in March that is on a Saturday. So there may not be a show that week, but we're going to plan on coming back next week and hopefully streaming live. We'll work out some kind of plan for April, may shift the day that we do it. I'll talk to folks and see if, there's some evening that it works out better.
Remind me, April, I haven't mentioned this to the board yet, but I'm planning another pub crawl, and that I did mention, but I'm aiming for the second Saturday in April.
Right, when I'll be in Plano doing my debate.
So, well, anyone who's thinking of coming into town is interested. I'm going to talk to the board tomorrow at the board meeting and try to get it up on the calendar. We already have T-shirt design, so it should be a great night. The previous pub crawls have gone very well.
Yeah, the previous pub crawls have gone so well that they outed my then-girlfriend and have encouraged all sorts of other things. So we're looking for that. Keep an eye on the calendar. Visit the Atheist Community of Austin's webpage, www.atheist-community.org, where we'll have notifications of any upcoming events. There's a calendar of events, frequently asked questions page. There's a way to contact us, so email, which includes the TV at, the radio at, and nonprofits at atheist-community.org. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Serious strife. Now you make the scene all day, but tomorrow they'll be held to pay.
In the afterlife, you'll be headed for the serious strife. Now you make the